Today on the Yoga with Jake podcast, I'm joined by award-winning health and culture journalist and a regular contributor to the New York Times Wealth section, Danielle Friedman. Danielle has written about everything from the joys of being a slow runner to the importance of pelvic floor conditioning. She's also the author of Let's Get Physical, How Women Discovered Exercise and Reshaped the World, which was selected as a New Yorker and Financial Times Best Book of 2022. She lives in New York City with her husband and their two young sons. As a fellow writer, I was very excited to talk to Danielle about her story and how she became such a renowned New York Times health journalist and author in the wellness and mental health space, how she personally approaches movement and working out as a busy mom and through the lens of a health reporter, her writing process, her favorite articles, profiles, sources, and topics she's covered, how we should be making movement more accessible and inclusive. We also talk about focusing on how exercise makes you feel rather than just how you look, the importance of mixing up movement practices like Pilates, cardio, such as running, how she embraces the art of running slow, and also lifting weights. We also talk about the trends in the fitness and wellness world, and in the age of media, podcasts, how we are completely saturated with health information, how she, as a professional journalist, discerns what is legitimate and what is not, and her most recent article, How to Exercise When It Feels Impossible. Please enjoy my conversation with Danielle Friedman for episode number 57 of the Yoga with Jake podcast.
Good morning.
Hey, Danielle. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this today. I so appreciate it. It means a lot. You are an award-winning journalist whose stories have graced the front page of the New York Times. Your book, Let's Get Physical, How Women Discovered Exercise and Reshaped the World, is a New Yorker Best Book of the Year. And so as a health journalist, I'm going to try not to fanboy too much, but I am so honored to have this time with you and to pick your brain a little bit. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your background and your work.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I'm so happy to be here. I have been at this for a little over 20 years now, which is crazy. But so I started my career as a nonfiction book editor at Penguin, where I worked on a lot of health-related titles, pop culture, humor, memoir, a little bit of everything. I actually come from what I think of as kind of a medical family. My dad is a retired gastroenterologist. My sister is a gynecologic surgeon. So I've always sort of toggled these two worlds between, you know, an interest in medicine and science and health, and of course, you know, writing and storytelling. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I spent many years as an editor in newsrooms, The Daily Beast, NBC News Digital, a startup called Fusion. But I was always I was always happiest, to be honest, when I was writing myself. So about 7 years ago, I struck out on my own, and that's really when I felt like I was able to, you know, dive in headfirst to my work. It's when the seeds for my book, Let's Get Physical, were planted, and that ended up being about a 4 to 5 year project. And then for the past couple of years, I've been contributing regularly to the New York Times Well section, writing about everything from the culture of fitness and medicine to an extent, as well as the latest science on how we move. And I'm always, you know, I would say kind of the guiding principle of my work, the way I approach my work, is to really approach it from a place of empathy and compassion, which I try to show myself as well when it comes to movement.
That's harder sometimes, right?
It is. But I think there's such a long history of movement culture, exercise culture, being about kind of like discipline and having, you know, this punitive tone, that I'm trying to do my small part in undoing that and helping people discover, you know, the joy and movement.
Mm, I love that. I always say to folks, that's why I like yoga, because it gives you grace, I feel, more so than what I was used to growing up as a college wrestler. It's like, not good enough, not good enough, go harder. And right. And I feel that leads to a lot of, it kind of permeates your personality over time, where you're just like, if you tell, you're told you're not good enough long enough, you just start believing that you're not good enough, I feel.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that applies, I think, to every aspect, you know, of life, but especially to movement. And we have these sort of false, honestly, these like false binaries of what it means to be an athlete. You're either athletic or you're not, which is so silly. Like, we're human beings, you know, we're wired to move. So I think everyone should think of themselves as an athlete.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems as though research shows that being active, moving your body, when it comes to keeping your brain healthy, even when compared to like these brain games, puzzles and stuff as we age, movement still takes the cake, right?
Yeah. Yeah. As far as I'm aware. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think, you know, mind and body obviously are so interconnected. And I think I've been pleased and sort of encouraged to see, just even over the past few years, the way in which research into mind and body have sort of started to connect more and more. And there's been more research on the ways in which exercise and movement not only contributes to what you were saying with sort of, you know, cognitive sharpness, but also mental health, emotional health. And, you know, and even just like the way that you think of yourself as a person in the world and your ability and your, you know, your functional capacity. I really think like that whole, the, you know, age old idea of feeling young at heart can contribute to, you know, behaving young, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now how could one, in your experience, how could one continue to keep exercise on their plate and continue to evolve and stay mentally healthy? What would you suggest as someone who, you know, wrote the book about, you know, women in fitness and exercise? And should someone seek out a mixture of workouts, or what would you suggest are things, something that will keep them exercising, keep them interested? You know, what would your suggestion be as a general, I guess, broad idea of what exercise should look like for folks?
Well, I think first and foremost, we all need to give ourselves some grace when it comes to movement, and recognizing that, you know, our bodies change over time, and our ability to move will change depending on the season of life. I mean, I had my second child. He's almost 14 months now. And, you know, I mean, it's been so wonderful to get back to what feels like my baseline level of movement, maybe even more in the past few months. But I think, you know, it's easy to feel like we're often kind of conditioned to feel like exercise is this all or nothing pursuit. And lifestyle. I mean, which, you know, there are gym chains that have slogans like, it's not exercise, it's not fitness, it's life, you know. and so it's not so subtle. But I do think that, you know, that's not realistic for many of us. I also think, you know, research has shown that variety is really key to a long-term exercise habit. I mean, for really kind of obvious reasons, like not getting bored. And that also taps into what almost, you know, every exercise scientist that I interview will point out, which is that the best form of exercise is the one that you will do, period. Mm. You know, so it does kind of depend on like the individual, what they're capable of at that point in their life, physically, just practically. But once you, so, you know, find an exercise you enjoy, be kind to yourself, try to be kind of flexible in the way that you think about your practice. I've been really encouraged to see, especially since the pandemic, that sort of gentler forms of movement or practices like walking, you know, which we would have, I think, culturally kind of poo-pooed 15 years ago as exercise, have really taken on, you know, are being recognized as legitimate, and the science behind the benefits is really sort of flourishing. And then, I mean, that being said, if you feel, you know, if you feel like it's something that you want to do, don't be afraid to challenge yourself. And like we were saying a moment ago, you know, just because at a different point in your life, or at a different gym, you know, you weren't, you know, you might've had an experience that taught you that, like, you didn't think of yourself as strong or athletic or whatever it may be. There are other gyms and you know, and finding a form of exercise that feels good doesn't have to mean gentle. So it could be, if you're really motivated to train for a marathon and the idea of doing something hard feels really, you know, just exciting, great, you know. Similarly with like lifting heavy weights, if that's something that feels like something that you know, that is bringing you pride and you want to do, great. But just listen to what feels good, and don't be afraid and limited by maybe your previous experiences.
Yeah, I think that's a great message. And it feels good once you get used to challenging yourself. Like, even if you fall short, you know, it's nice to have an aim. I got very into running since the pandemic started. I had previous life ran all the time, injured myself, and then revisited it. And the whole 80-20 balance. And I know you've had also, I think it was you that wrote about slow running and the the profound benefit of and embracing the slow. And
yes,
that is a good message that I need to take to heart, I feel. And I think that's, like, it's important to challenge yourself when you feel like you need that challenge, but also, you know, let the slow days be slow as well.
Exactly. Yeah. It's cliche now, but it is often just about, you know, listening to your body, listening to what you need and what you, what feels right in that cycle of life.
Yeah. And what does that look like for you personally? Do you run? Do you Pilates, yoga? Like, what do you mix it up? Does your job send you on different assignments so you get to try a bunch of different things? And yeah, I can imagine, well, I know myself, everything's a story. So I go to a class and I'm like, oh boy, we could write two different stories here. And what does that look like for you?
Yeah. I mean, I will say it is, you know, sometimes I struggle to carve out the time to exercise because I now have like two young children and work and just the realities of life. But the fact that it is also, I can work out in the name of, you know, my professional life definitely gives me an extra incentive and has led to my time in fitness spaces has led to so many stories over the past couple of years, and including my book, which grew out of my time doing bar.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, really tough. And with a really fascinating backstory as well. That was, yeah, a total gateway to the history of fitness for me. But yeah, so I've always been a runner. My dad, who is now almost 76, is a lifelong runner as well. And I really credit him with, I mean, he for so long has always like drilled in that I'm an athlete, and we run a lot of races together. Often he's faster than me, even at, you know, at 76.
Wow.
And, but he is such a joyful runner and does it, you know, he's always seen it as kind of moving meditation. And so I've been fortunate to inherit that as well. So I've run since high school, really, but yes, I am. I have work to practice pace acceptance because I'm not fast. And I, since training for the New York City Marathon in 2016, I've actually done the Galloway method, which is run, walk, run. And it incorporates, it was started by the Olympian Jeff Galloway. It incorporates walk breaks, basically, which interestingly often lead, you know, to finishing either at the same pace that you would if you were just running, or sometimes even faster, because you're giving your muscles these strategic, you know, times to recover, basically. And for me, the Galloway method has been just a godsend because it has helped to prevent injury. It has helped me ease back into movement when I'm, you know, following pregnancy and surgery and things like that. And so, yeah, right now, fingers crossed, I'm very excited about my roster of races for the year. I got into the Brooklyn Half Marathon, and I actually signed up for all women's marathon in November, which would be my first since 2016. So hopefully that will happen.
Wow. Congrats.
Thanks. I do Pilates. I do Pilates once a week, which has been, I have become such a convert. And I have to say, actually, I wrote about Pilates for the New York Times. I guess it was like the summer of 22. And I had dabbled before and enjoyed it, but that story, it was basically investigating like if it's all it's cracked up to be. Mm-hmm. And my conclusion was yes. And so that propelled me to keep at it. And I also just recently started doing I want to call it like heavy lifting, you know, basically weight training involving more serious, heavier loads, basically, which again, like after, you know, countless interviews with exercise scientists about the benefits of strength training and lifting, especially as we get older, I was like, okay, I got to get back to it. And I needed to wait till it was safe for me and it felt comfortable. But as soon as I got there, I started it on it and I really love it.
Okay. Wow. That's a lot. And you're a mom and you're mixing it up. And what sold you on Pilates? Have you done Megaformer Pilates, like the solid core type of classes?
No, I'm a little bit like, I mean, honestly, true. I'm a little scared. Yeah. Of those and like,
those are like torture machines. They are very difficult. You're doing more of the traditional mat Pilates then? Okay.
Well, actually, not mat so much, but, you know, reformer, mm-hmm. tower, Cadillac, like all the classical equipment and also some mat. But it's definitely more, I'm not getting my cardio in the Pilates studio. You know, mm-hmm. it's really about the stretching and the mind body and the strengthening. Yeah.
Awesome. And I always found with all these modalities, if you find the right teacher, like for me, I really need someone to focus on form. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is most of the battle. I feel if you find someone who's really passionate about Pilates, for me at least, and loves making sure you do it right for the most benefit and your form and everything, like it's all about, I think, finding the right teacher sometimes.
I totally agree. And I had some experiences with sort of less than ideal teachers in the past. Some instructors who are like a little bit checked out. And that was when I was reporting the Pilates story, everybody who I interviewed who were really like the veterans and the masters in the field, you know, were saying the instructor matters and their level of training and their level of passion. And I'm really fortunate to have found somebody who, you know, is amazing. And actually I first went to her when I was pregnant. So we did prenatal and then postpartum. And now it's been so gratifying to get to kind of progress to do like regular Pilates.
I love that. Yeah. And you find most of the benefit is in strengthening with Pilates. Then you said it's not so much for your cardio. Is it more so being more self-aware about how your body moves in space? You know, there's a lot going on, it looks like, in Pilates. What is that benefit for you?
Yeah, it is that it is, you know, fostering that mind-body connection, being able to kind of tap into, or they would say activate and connect with muscles and regions that I might not have been previously, you know, even aware of. And I mean, for me, it's served a pretty specific purpose. And I have had two C-sections. And so I really, you know, after you give birth, even however you give birth, it's like you're starting from, you can feel really diminished strength wise, and your core is really affected, of course. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was sort of just like, rebuilding this base level of strength, and especially core strength, which Pilates is really great for, so that I then felt strong enough, and it was, and you know, safe. I felt comfortable from a safety perspective, engaging in higher impact activities. But it really, I mean, it is a really great core strengthening modality and full body, but it, and I also just find the machines fun. Like, again, Megaformer, I don't know, I can't say, but like the regular reformer, because it's a little bit like, you know, I don't know, doing water aerobics or moving in a pool, because it, you know, that your some of your body weight is the machine supports you basically. And it can feel a little bit like play, which I like.
Yeah. There's something great about, I found a Megaformer studio. They're no longer open since COVID, unfortunately, but they really slowed it down. Boy, did it make it harder. But there's something sweet about the novel movement with the machine. Once you get going, from a distance looking at it, you're like, this looks like a torture machine.
Yes.
And confusing. Yes. But yeah, when it comes to like processing, like you almost feel like a meditation and movement with that novel machine. And there's something about Pilates too that helps you locate your core on a deep level and to understand it, how to engage it. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done a lot of reporting on the pelvic floor as well. And it's also great for, you know, this is important for men and women, or I should say women and men. I think we're more aware of pelvic floor issues in women, but some of the deep core muscles and the transverse abdominis muscles and the, you know, pelvic floor, so important for function and strength and preventing injury. But we're just often very unaware of them. And Pilates is really focused on the pelvic floor. So that's been nice too. Yeah.
Love that. And you brought up how your work as a wellness journalist, a health journalist, how it kind of gives you the nudge to try different things and exercise in different ways. And I was wondering, your writing process, do you have a process? Like when you're looking for story ideas, you know, once you see put on the journalist hat, it's hard to take it off. I've noticed it's like everything could be a story. I was curious, you know, what your process is like. And in a world that we're saturated with health podcasts, a ton of information thrown at us. Gosh, I listen to so many that then I go to laser focus to one topic. For example, I wrote about yoga nidra, which I love, and was initially sparked my interest with some of the research that was brought forward by a certain podcaster that was accurate-ish, truthy, as I like to say. But I think to myself that, boy, if I was just like listening to this and didn't dive 100 miles deep into this one specific topic, I would just be led to believe that yoga nidra, you know, saved everything. And, you know, which it has profound benefits. But, you know, I think we're in this age of like, it's hard to do the arduous, boring, difficult journalistic work, right? Of digging deeply into certain specific topics. And so I was wondering if you have a process or something that, what that looks like for you, as far as from beginning to what do you think is a relevant topic, and then how you start that process of doing the journalism work.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I always, I think about something I was taught in journalism school, in grad school, which has really stayed with me, which is the idea of you know, pay attention to what you pay attention to. So if there's something that kind of, you know, if you're living your daily life and you hear someone casually mention something and you go, and it stops you in your tracks, or just, you know, sometimes it's subtle, but you're like, huh, like, that's often a good sign, you know, that's often a signal that there's something there worth exploring. I also, you know, I think it's helpful to basically, I try to see myself as a kind of every person, every woman in the fitness space. I've never been an elite athlete. I think I'm a good stand-in, and even now I'm in my 40s, and I feel like age-wise, and you know, I try to think about the reader and be a stand-in for the reader, basically. And so I will also say that that being said, because I am so saturated in this space and it is so much of what I live and breathe, if I hear or see something that feels new or different to me, you know, I feel like that's usually a pretty good sign that it will surprise our readers too. Of course, I have to check and make sure, you know, Times didn't cover it like 2 weeks ago or 18 months ago. But, and then once I've identified a story, as far as my work at the Times, you know, I'll discuss it with my editor and we'll talk about its viability as a story for the paper. For other publications or for, you know, even with my book, sometimes I'll start by going down a research rabbit hole and again, making sure there's really something there. And then, I mean, for me, the reporting and the research and what might seem, you know, like tedium is actually part of the fun of it for me. I mean, I guess it's a sign that I'm in the right profession, but I love having, it feels like such a privilege to get to interview experts and, you know, people who lived so many of these experiences across the health realm. And so, you know, identify the story, I think really specifically about the angle and kind of what the headline might be, what my central argument is. And then I will just basically research and interview until I get to the point where I can kind of predict what the source is going to say. You know, that was another journalism school takeaway, you know, that has been really helpful. Like when you start either educating the source, you know, or you can kind of predict, okay, then you've probably reached the level of having, you know, equipping yourself with the right amount of information. Nerd out. I mean, yeah, I'm very process driven. I also, because I spent so many years as an editor, you know, I think in a pretty like structured way. And so, and for me, there's also, of course, you know, just all of the little tricks that I think we all develop to avoid writer's block or the intimidation of a blank page. And I'm really big into like outlining, you know, once I feel like the story exists in my brain, you know, I'll sit down at the computer and just kind of do like a stream of conscious outline that often is almost the length that I need to be at for the story. And then I can go in and refine it, fill in the blanks and self-edit. It makes it easier for me.
Mm. I love that. And I always feel fortunate to find good sources and super grateful. Sometimes they are just gems in helping to hold your hand if you're like looking in the wrong direction and you're like, oh boy, this is something totally, especially in the beginning.
Yeah.
And now from start to finish, as a freelancer, are you given a deadline, or could this be like a process over months, or are you given some leeway? Like, could you dive deep into something? Like what lights you up as a writer? Is it the stories that are like, hey, this story's due in like 2 hours. You've got this many inches to cover. You think of old school journalism that way, but do you prefer, do you have a preference, or do you have a choice as to what you get to write and how you approach it?
Yeah, I do not like deadlines. I mean, they're probably useful for me, and I, you know, for productivity and output, but my ideal process would be to just, I mean, honestly, a lot of the work that I do for stories happens when I'm not actively working. You know, it's the kind of percolating, the sleeping on it. I find that just, you know, it's almost like like a computer where you have to reboot, you know, I really like to be at a place where I feel like I have mastery over the subject. and I know how all the puzzle pieces fit together before I actually sit down to write. Of course, though, you know, I'm living in the real world. And and so I do have deadlines, but they vary depending on the scope of the story, you know, and also whether there's like a timely, you know, a timeliness and news peg, if it's, you know, pegged to like a new book coming out or a study, I have to take that into consideration as well. Mm. But many of the stories I've worked on over the past few years have taken months. And hopefully, you know, I believe quality reporting and can, you know, leads to quality stories. And I think I can say that the stories, you know, that have required more investment have really paid off in the impact that they've made and the response they've gotten.
Mm. Love that. Did you have any stories in particular that really jump out for you that you loved or were your favorites? I mean, you've written so much, but maybe just in the recently, if there's any that jump out for you.
Yeah. Well, I have grown to love writing profiles, and that really, that was a love that was cultivated while writing my book. My book is really character driven. You know, it tells the stories of these mostly forgotten pioneers who helped to shape and create basically the current fitness landscape. And so in the past year, I wrote two pretty big profiles, including one that did make it onto the front page of the New York Times. One was of, Martinez Evans, the founder of the Slow AF Run Club. And that whole piece was just a labor of love. I had interviewed Martinez for a different story a year before, actually about my own journey of pace acceptance and learning to love being a slow runner. And he's just an incredibly inspiring guy. He did have a new book out, and it was just so, it was a feel good story. It was all about showing yourself empathy. I mean, it was just the sort of represented the nexus of so many things that I care about. And it was really amazing to see the way that readers connected with it. You know, I was like, in these cynical times, you never know how. I didn't set out to write like a feel good story. It just, he has created a movement that's based on joy and, you know, and sort of meeting yourself where you are. And so that was an amazing experience. And then I wrote a profile I think it ended up publishing like early fall, late summer last year, about Elaine LaLanne, who is the 97-year-old widow of Jack LaLanne.
Yeah.
You know, one of the very first kind of fitness evangelists in this country, and had a very long running TV show. And I got to spend time with her in the home that she had shared with Jack for decades. And it was just a living museum, really, to fitness history. And she's incredible. I mean, as a person, she's just was just a delight to spend time with. And she also, you know, she's walking the walk. She still exercises every day. And I really enjoy, in general, just when I speaking with people in that stage of life, you know, people in their 80s, 90s, who have lived a lifetime or a near lifetime of movement, and, you know, hearing kind of what their perspective is now. And then I'll just share one other story that I recently published that like directly grew out of my experience in the Pilates studio, was a piece about the fact that yoga instructors, Pilates instructors, body workers like massage therapists, and just fitness and body, you know, professionals of all kinds have been taking it upon themselves to attend. It's a little graphic, but basically cadaver dissection workshops to enhance their understanding of anatomy and to better serve their clients. And that piece happened because I was literally on a reformer doing Pilates, and my instructor casually mentioned something about the body she had learned in a dissection. And I did a, you know, a double take, and I said, wait, what part of your Pilates training involved cadaver dissection? And, you know, and here I had written this piece where people are like, your instructor and their training is so important. I'm like, this never came up. And it opened my eyes to this whole world. I attended a dissection, and it ended up the piece. It was interesting to see the response. I mean, people, it elicited a pretty wide range of reactions to this concept. But in my experience, the instructors who were seeking out this training, everybody was doing so because they were really committed to their clients and to their craft, and felt like they hadn't gotten the kind of education that they wanted or needed in their traditional training. And so that was just a really fascinating piece. And also, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of interesting work happening now around basically bridging the gap between medicine and fitness. You know, we always know, we say exercise is medicine, so many doctors will recommend it, but historically, there has not been a lot of communication between the medical world and the fitness world and the movement world. So it was a really interesting kind of, you know, example of how those bridges are starting to form and where they could potentially go.
That's so interesting. Did you happen to run into Gil Headley's work or? Okay.
Yeah. I interviewed Gil for the piece. Yeah. And many of his disciples, and actually the instructor who originally told me about it had attended one of Gil's workshops.
Yeah, I've had Gil on and spoke with him at length. He's on this Nerve tour. Have you seen that?
Yeah. I think I hope to attend when they're in New York. Really fascinating guy. Fascinating.
Very fascinating. And his wife, Rachel, they're doing really interesting, great work. I'm hoping to catch them in Philly. Interesting. Okay. And the Slow AF runner, that movement in his brand, Slow AF Running, stemmed from somebody calling him out for running slow during a race, right? If I remember right. Can you remind me what sparked that?
Yeah. I mean, I think he had a number of experiences that laid the groundwork for launching this movement. But there was an actual inciting incident, which was he was running the New York City Marathon in 2018. And I don't know if you've ever seen the course or run the course. He had just come off of the 59th Street Bridge, which is notoriously, it's so grueling, and it's right around mile 16 too. So things are really starting to get hard, and he's just, you know, he's moving along. He has his AirPods in, and someone on the sidelines, who may or may not have been intoxicated, but was just a jerk nonetheless, shouted out to him, like, you know, "You're slow AF, buddy, go home." I think he used the actual expletive, but and Martinez took his, he's like, "What did you say?" And the guy repeated it, and, you know, he's like, "You go home." And so it was so demeaning and unnecessary. And Martinez was just, you know, it kind of started as anger, and he had time to think about it as he finished the course. And then this is kind of his personality, he decided to basically own being slow, you know, recognizing that he was hardly alone. And so the next time he raced, he wore a shirt with like a cute cartoon turtle on it that said slow AF. And other people in the back of the pack were like, I want that shirt. And so, you know, one thing led to another. And eventually he formed this run club, which it's virtual. There's an app. There's a lot of merch to show your slow AF pride. He's really become this kind of icon. He initially started, he had a blog back in the like bloggy days and his Instagram handle still is 300 pounds and running because he is 300 pounds and he had had some also kind of discriminatory incidents, with doctors. And, he recognizes that historically there have not been a lot of people who look like him. He's Black. He comes from Detroit, where he didn't know a lot of people who ran recreationally. He's bigger. And he believes that running should be for everybody.
Hmm. So sweet. And, you know, your book brings up like inclusivity when it comes to exercise, right? And you write about this and speak on this. Where do you think we could get better as fitness and yoga instructors, or in general, looking at fitness and overall movement? You know, where do we stand? Where do you think, you know, I go to, I still once in a while drop into a Bikram yoga studio. And I know that, you know, the history and the dark history with the founder and the things that I have heard said during these classes are boggling. Like, I am like almost regretful of not standing up and saying in front of the whole room, like, go to whatever, because it is horrific. Some of the things I've heard in a yoga class like that, that is not an outlier when it comes to Bikram, at least, but that is the extreme. But do you think we've made some headway with being more inclusive and making fitness more about how you feel and less about how you look? Or where do you think we stand as a culture in the fitness world?
Yeah, I think we've made some headway. You know, I do think that at least in many fitness spaces, it has become, a lot of instructors and professionals have stopped referring to people's physical appearance or, you know, physical condition at all, and focused more on how fitness makes you feel, which I think is a good start. You know, of course, just because like it's not being spoken doesn't mean that those biases and beliefs don't still exist. But I do think there has been an expansion, and I can say this as someone, you know, who has studied kind of the arc of history and fitness. And there has been some progress in recognizing that a fit body doesn't look just one way. You know, like you take someone like Martinez, who's run, I can't even remember how many, you know, I think he's run 9 marathons at this point, but you know, it's there for a really long time. There was so little representation and diversity in what a fit body looked like that it was just really drilled into us from forever that being fit meant being thin, you know, devoid of fat, pretty much toned, which is not even a real physiological thing. It just means, you know, having visible muscle, which you're usually either like genetically predisposed to or not. Mm-hmm. I think social media, for as much as it can obviously be toxic and it can help to promote a lot of misinformation in this space, has also really done a lot of good for representation and allowing, you know, fitness influencers, for lack of a better word, or professionals who have really positive messaging and who would never have gained the influence that they have now in like the previous non-social media world, you know, in those power structures. It has allowed them to become visible and build followings and allow their followings to see someone who looks like them and has the values that they have, you know, as a leader and to follow their lead. So that's been good. And I think one of my missions, sort of, which is equally a pet peeve, or has grown out of a pet peeve, is just spreading the message that our fitness, our health, is not nearly as in our control as the fitness industry has led us to believe for many, many years. You know, for so long, exercise and fitness and movement has been about, it's been seen as a reflection of willpower, of our character, of our work ethic. And, you know, when you look at it that way, the flip side is that, okay, if you don't appear fit or you are not able to make time for movement in your life, well, what does that mean? Okay, you're lazy, you don't have a strong work ethic, you know, all of these negative traits that I think there's something very American about this. You know, we celebrate work ethic and discipline, and we look down on the opposite. And so, you know, we now know that, I mean, we've always known, but for so many reasons, there are so many people who do not have access to fitness spaces. They don't have the time to move. They don't have the physical ability to participate in mainstream, you know, fitness culture. And I think it's really, you know, I just think taking a more compassionate view and looking at how we can meet people where they are, how we can improve access, will go a long way toward improving public health at large.
Yeah, one thing I love about yoga, if it's approached the right way, if you could breathe, you could do something with yoga. It's relatively affordable. That's a whole nother difficult thing as a yoga teacher, though. Boy, the business model is so brutal for teachers.
Yeah.
And studios, I think, too, though I think they maybe have a better go at it because they could churn out more teachers, have them work for free, essentially, for a while, which is a good and bad thing because you get to, you know, cut your teeth and make mistakes and learn. But also, you know, making a living is a thing. And
yeah,
it's very, I feel, systemic the way it's set up, the problems that you see as far as accessibility, boundaries to entry. I always say, as someone who teaches men's yoga, yoga studios, I don't think, do themselves any favors when, like, you don't see many minorities or men in yoga class. Right. And I feel like we're failing on every level on that. And I've got opinions about why. But when you hang up signs that essentially say you're not welcome here in so many words, like, it's like, don't you want to make an impact? Yet yoga teachers will be like, yo, we taught a class for at a prison for prisoners, but they don't want to teach a Republican or something. You know, like, it's just interesting to me that we set up these boundaries and barriers to entry, kind of self-inflicted, yet we push this philosophy of all-inclusive. Just, I think it takes a lot of self-awareness. And I think, again, like, the business model set up in a way that yoga is, at least I can only speak to, well, a lot of fitness classes, they've upped their prices, but you could find accessible yoga, but it takes a lot of digging. And I just feel there's a lot of things there that need to shift, like, at its core. Like, I wish that yoga and exercise fitness in general was somehow like maybe bridging that gap between the medical world and the fitness world, like you mentioned, needs to happen. Maybe they could prescribe, fitness or yoga to folks, or movement in general, and give them some sort of access to these things. But it's cultural too, I feel, you know, it's a big topic. There's a lot going on there, I feel.
Yeah. And I think, fitness in many ways is a luxury. It's definitely a privilege, you know, in this country. Mm-hmm. But having the time, the space, the financial resources to be able to move, it's still a luxury. But I also think that, you know, a shift that would be really beneficial is to stop as a culture thinking about movement as optional and as a luxury, you know, and more if there were more societal cultural support given to making movement accessible to everybody. I just think that, you know, as I said, that would do so much good, because even with the work that I do, you know, everything I write about, I still struggle with feeling a little bit indulgent, I guess, for carving time out of my day to move. And I it's like, I know rationally on so many levels that that's not rational, you know, but I guess maybe it is just recognizing for me that it is a privilege, and trying to look at the sort of the long game of, you know, when we focus on our own movement and our own well-being, it can also not only help us, but help others in our lives. So anyway, I think though culturally, the more we start to view movement as, you know, not an optional form of leisure pursuit, but as something essential to health and well-being, I think we will all benefit.
Yeah, I think that's well put. I get that same feeling when I'm at a yoga class in the middle of the day. Like, how lucky am I? Mm-hmm. I almost feel guilty.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? Yeah.
You know, I initially wanted to talk to you about your article about fascia. I know we're coming up against the time window, and I really want to respect your time, but is there anything else that you want to put out there for folks in general? You know, I like that we did more of this kind of big picture view on your background and where we stand with, you know, health and fitness and accessibility. But is there anything else that you're currently working on, or anything that you want to bring up about any of your recent articles, anything at all that you want to put out there?
Ah, great question. Yeah, we really have covered so much. I did write about fascia last year. Fascia is fascinating. And Gil Headley, who you mentioned, is a leader in the field of fascia research. If anyone's curious, you know, you can check out my story for the Times. We are, I will just say, yeah, we are in a really interesting moment of, so little was known about fascia for so long because it was just disregarded as kind of the, you know, the waste product, basically, like the inert packaging that our muscles and every part of us was wrapped in, that it's like almost, you know, every study being done has the potential to discover something new. So if you want to learn more about your fascia and how to care for it, you can check out my story. And then, yeah, I recently kind of pegged to the new year. I wrote a piece for the Times. I think my last piece for the Times was about how to basically overcome some of the most common barriers to exercise, both sort of perceived barriers, circumstantial ones, and the importance of when we're not able to move in the way that we want, to not thinking of those barriers as excuses. This is another kind of soapbox issue that I have, but when we, you know, and the sources that I interviewed really kind of backed this up, but basically when you think of your reasons for not exercising as excuses, not only are you suggesting that you're moving because you're accountable to somebody else, but you're making it, you know, you're turning it into a chore, you're turning it into a should. And as we started this conversation by discussing, you know, ideally The best form of exercise is the one you'll enjoy. And if you think about movement as kind of a gift to yourself, as doing something kind for yourself, it really just, I think, helps to shift that perception. So I talk about everything from feeling like you have zero time, zero energy, fear of injury, the extreme weather. And while, there are going to be some barriers that just maybe, like I was saying before, it's just not the right season of life. There are often workarounds. And if it's something that you really want to incorporate into your life.
I love that. Sometimes I'll stare at my running shoes for over an hour before I lace them up even. And it requires like maybe a mile long walk before I'll get the gumption to start to trot and then slowly jog. And sometimes that's the hardest part, I feel, is to
totally
get going.
Yeah. That actually reminds me something that the psychologist Kelly McGonigal, author of a book called The Joy of Movement, shared with me, which I thought was such great advice, was something that can be really helpful in getting started is what she called a state change. So basically, instead of saying like, okay, like I'm going to go for a 3-mile run, let's get going. If you're having some trouble, do something small that will lead to a state change. And so that could be listening to a song that you love and maybe just kind of like dancing or moving to the song. If you've been inside, go outside. Just engaging in something that will help to shift your environment and maybe your mood ever so slightly, so that then you're like, you know what? It feels good. And it reminds you of, that it feels good to move around a little, to be in a different environment, and then see how it goes from there.
Yeah. I always feel things like a Peloton, the things we do at home are great and accessible. However, there is something about getting out of your house that shifts something for me. And that's so cool. I love that it's linked to the psychology, actual psychology behind it.
Yeah.
So sweet. All right. Well, you're doing such great work. I'm a huge fan. And I really enjoyed this conversation. I really appreciate your time. And for folks, go check out Danielle Friedman's work, writer for the New York Times, author of a book, Let's Get Physical, How Women Discovered Exercise and Reshaped the World. I really, really love all that you're doing and putting out great work. Is there any place else that we could point folks to find you?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for all of the kind words. I really appreciate it. And you can also find me on Instagram at Danielle Friedman Writes, and I share pretty much all my work there, as well as the occasional fun archival fitness artifact. So Danielle Friedman Writes.
Wonderful. Okay. Sounds good. I appreciate it. I'd love to check in and do this again. If there's topics that you write about that you want to unpack on a podcast, I'd love to have you back. This is great.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. This has been fun.
Right. Take care.
You too.
Thanks for tuning in. If you found my conversation with Danielle to be helpful, informative, if it got you thinking, please give the podcast a like, a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe. And you can follow me on all social media platforms at Yoga with Jake, especially on Instagram, and on my website, yogawithjake.com. Until next time, take care.